Hello, and welcome to New Books in Communications, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Jeff Pooley of Muhlenberg College, and I'm here today to talk to Sarah Benet Weiser, professor at the USC Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, about her new book, Authentic Trademark, The Politics of Ambivalence in a Brand Culture, which was published in 2012 by NYU Press. Welcome to New Books in Communications, Sarah, and thanks for clearing out the time to talk to me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, the book is a fascinating exploration of brand culture, in which you note has long since spread from business and marketing into other spheres of social life that, in our imaginations at least, we had perceived as being left untouched. The self, for example, politics, religion, even creativity. And the book in particular focuses on the paradoxical way in which authenticity and promotion coexist. It argues that economic imperatives and authenticity, in quotation marks, are expressed and experienced at the same time, simultaneously, in a culture of brands that goes deep. It's a treatment that refuses to reduce the one, authenticity, to the other, economic drives. It's a really provocative and interesting book, and I'm very excited to talk to you about it today.
Thanks.
So could you start off just by saying a little bit about your background? I mean, what brought you into media studies in the first place?
Sure. My PhD is in communication, and I started out not really as a traditional media studies scholar, but more a feminist theorist, historical materialist, cultural studies type person. And my first book was on the Miss America pageant, which I considered media sort of writ large, but it wasn't on traditional media so much. I mean, I talked about the televised pageant, but it was really about public performances of femininity and public performances of national identity and how that worked in a mediated world. My second book, I focused much closer on something very traditional to media studies, which was a television network, and I wrote a book on the cable network Nickelodeon, and talked about niche channels and really became interested in the processes and the development of a brand since I traced Nickelodeon historically as the development of a branded network for kids. So it sort of led kind of logically to thinking more and more about brand culture, especially as I was following the economic context of, you know, advanced capitalism to neoliberal capitalism. And the book is about media. I have a couple of chapters that are really specifically media focused, social media focused. But the other chapters are also on, like you said, creativity, which really focuses on street art, which I also consider media, and politics and the way in which politics is woven into media practices and the way in which politics are practiced as mediated practices. So my focus on media is really a pretty broad look, and I feel like I have a very broad definition of what counts as media. So it's not specifically broadcast or digital media, but it's, you know, the kinds of cultural practices that we engage in our everyday lives.
Fair enough. And, you know, that is itself probably a reflection in part, isn't it, of the UCSD, UC San Diego's heritage that you have, in which communication is defined expansively?
Yeah. I understand now that, you know, probably kind of jokingly, that the San Diego School is called the La Jolla School, or the UCSD School of Communication is called the La Jolla School. But it certainly is a very expansive view of communication. And it remains, and it was when I was in graduate school there, a very untraditional take on communication as a discipline. And so I think that my work is a clear reflection of that expansive view of what communication means and what media means, and how these media and communication practices are always imbricated within cultural and power dynamics.
Great. And, you know, you mentioned that this book is your third, and that the last one on Nickelodeon and branded kid culture has some obvious connections to this one, but is there a story about how you came to tackle this particular topic? What was it that, you know, led you to, you know, authenticity and brand culture?
Well, there's a theoretical trajectory that I think is threaded through all of my work. I'm hoping other people see that it's threaded through all of my work. It may just be that I see it, but the first book on the pageant was about national identity, really, for women. And I was trying to figure out what were some of the cultural practices of and performances of national identity that were very specific to women, unlike, say, the military for men or sports for men. And then I remained very interested in the cultural definitions of national identity. And so that led me to thinking about how television networks were increasingly addressing their audiences through a nationalist frame or through a patriotic frame. And Nickelodeon, I became interested in Nickelodeon in part because they had this very successful and widespread promo campaign where they talked to their children, their child audience as citizens. You might remember it. It was, you know, the Nick Nation moment, right? And you know, they used patriotic language and patriotic logic as a way to not only address their child audience, but to actually form that audience and imagine that audience. And so I sort of tightened my interest in national identity and became more focused on consumer citizenship and how I saw that kids who were Nickelodeon audiences were addressed as certain sorts of consumer citizens. That idea of consumer citizenship still is sort of the heart of my theoretical inquiries into culture and into communication and media. So the brand book, Authentic, really is also about how consumers are addressed as citizens and how brands become the mediascape or the landscape on which we identify ourselves and imagine ourselves as particular kinds of citizens. The idea of the reason why I focused in or honed in on authenticity is because our ideas about ourselves as citizens often revolve around this notion of authenticity, which is very hard to define and is defined very differently. And in fact, I'm not actually offering a new definition of authenticity in the book, but I really wanted to connect these ideas of authenticity and citizenship and explore how these ideas were sort of coalesced within brands and brand logic and how we identified ourselves as citizens through not only the purchases we make, but how we feel to be part of a narrative of a brand, part of the story that the brand tells.
Great. Yeah. And you know, you already mentioned the authenticity theme, and you know, the title is devilishly clever and indeed has this paradox built into it, the authentic followed by the trademark symbol. And I thought maybe as a way into the book, since it is layered and rich, you might just say something about, you know, that title, the authentic with the trademark symbol, and also in the subtitle, the emphasis placed on ambivalence, which is a theme throughout the book. If you could just say something about those two title words.
Sure. I'm actually going to start with the subtitle first, if that's okay. The idea of ambivalence is very important in the book. It's one of the core theoretical threads that I try to, you know, maintain and explore in each chapter. And the reason why I think it's important is because I set out to write this book as a sort of intervention, I guess, into the academic, popular, political, cultural debates over whether or not we are, you know, kind of liberated by the media, sort of a utopian viewpoint, or whether or not the media is something that controls our every action and is just about sort of surveillance to the point where we don't really have any agency. And this is, as you know, as a communication scholar yourself, this is a debate that continues to really shape a lot of the academic explorations into media. It really shapes what we can see in digital media spaces and broadcast media spaces and so on. And so I just felt like while I understand both sides of this debate, I also feel like it's sort of paralyzing for us in terms of moving a conversation forward and really trying to think about what's at stake in living our lives through brands, for example. What's at stake in living our lives or constructing our identities in social or digital media? And I don't think you can get to that question, that stakes question, if you maintain this binary that it's either, you know, consumer is empowered through the media or consumer is suffocated by the media. So I wanted to write something that explored sort of the liminal spaces between those two points on that continuum. And what I found was that it made the most sense to think about culture as an ambivalent space, as something that is, you know, that is, can be about both agency and control simultaneously. And that that simultaneous, you know, when we're positioned as both consumer agents and we're controlled by consumer culture, that provides, or that, you know, gives a space of ambivalence. And so I really wanted to explore that in the book. I have to say that I started the project a little bit more optimistically than I ended the project, you know, after many, many interviews with brand marketers. And I did a sort of mini ethnography at an ad, major ad agency, and talked and gave, you know, had many interviews at the ad agency, and also just did a lot of research on these different campaigns. I think the book is more critical than I imagined it would be at the very beginning. But I really do think that the key for us in thinking about what it means to live our lives in neoliberal capitalism, what culture means, what it can mean, is about being critical of these things, but also recognizing that these are ambivalent spaces, that they're not determined spaces. They're not determined by consumer agency or free will or control or corporate hegemony. And so I think we need to be a little bit more layered in our analysis. And so that's why I focused on ambivalence, if that makes sense.
Completely. Yeah. Okay. And then in terms of the authenticity idea.
Yeah, in terms of the authenticity idea, when I started interviewing marketers and then started just talking to people about this project and reading marketing books and tons and tons of marketing books and looking at these different brand campaigns and from the ground up and how they're formed, I realized that so much of brand, the story of the brand as it's formulated by marketers, it revolves around this idea of authenticity. So they talk about, the brand marketers talk about establishing engaged, authentic relationships with consumers. They want to make a consumer feel like this is an authentic relationship that he or she may have with a brand. The authenticity for them is a really key term. But I also was struck by the fact that authenticity was a really key term for those people who resisted brands and resisted corporate culture and the whole specter of selling out. And, you know, if you buy into this, you're no longer authentic. And so authenticity was sort of marshaled as a key term or a key concept from many different perspectives within consumer culture and within consumers themselves. And so I started out to think about what is the role that authenticity plays? And the reason why I, you know, gave it the little TM, the trademark, is because my argument in the book is that authenticity is a branded concept. And again, I'm not making a new argument about authenticity, and I'm certainly not offering a new definition. This book is not like this is not the book to read if you want to figure out what authenticity means necessarily as a concept. But what I did want to say in the book is that authenticity works in contemporary culture as a brand more than anything else.
Great. And that really does come through. And you make an argument that, you know, authenticity, ironically, in a culture of selling seems to carry even more weight, and that the two are blurred in such a way that the blurring is even tolerated by both not just marketers in a way that might be predictable, but even by agents, consumers.
Yeah, it's tolerated. It's expected. I don't think, I've always come from a position where I have resisted any sort of cultural dupe argument where audiences or fans or consumers or whatever your, particular site may be are somehow duped by culture. Consumers aren't duped by branding either, right? They expect the idea of branded authenticity to come through in their brands, and they tolerate it, even if they still kind of maintain an idea of selling out or some sort of binary where there is some pure, pristine space outside of consumerism. But as you said, they tolerate the brand of authenticity. We come to expect it. If something doesn't have an authentic feel to it, even when we know that that's part of the brand, even when we know that that's part of the marketing message, we're disappointed. So I kind of wanted to explore that affect and that sentiment.
Right. Well, it really comes through. In fact, in the very first main substantive chapter, you deal with these issues. It's really looking at Dove's advertising over the years, but especially the Dove campaign for Real Beauty. When you're using that as a kind of case study to look at branding in terms of gender and commodity activism, and this campaign, which in many ways is a perfect example of kind of a branded authenticity, where the campaign invites you to download your free self-esteem tools, as you write about here in this chapter, and you do it really throughout the book. But you develop this idea that the commodity is distinct from the brand, and that the process of commoditizing is not the same as branding, or at least the brand culture. And so, maybe you could explain, using this example of Dove, that why brand culture is not just corporate appropriation.
Sure. The Dove chapter also is kind of the only chapter in the whole book where I use a specific brand. The book isn't about, it's not necessarily about specific brands, right? It's not about Starbucks or about Apple. It's more about brand culture and brand logic and brand language. But that chapter, I wanted to show historically how we move from the process of commodification to a broader, more diffused landscape of branding. And it seemed to make sense to use a brand that is wildly successful and that has a history in terms of advertising, marketing, and branding. And so Dove seemed to be the sort of perfect brand name to use as a lens or an optic to get a wider view of these different historical changes. So I look at Dove in the 1950s and talk about how, this was a very kind of broadcast model where the company really targeted an ideal consumer who was white and middle class and female, and then moved to the late capitalism period and niche marketing period, starting in the 70s and going up to the 90s, and looked at an example of Dove and how they targeted a different sort of consumer and how they started this trajectory towards authenticity and the idea of intimacy with the consumer and engagement that then becomes the buzzword in marketing in the 21st century, right? Engagement marketing and authenticity and so on. So I wanted to use that moment of niche marketing and targeted consumers of the 70s and the 80s to show that this, there is a history here towards brand culture. Brand culture isn't the way I'm talking about it isn't a sort of inevitability, right? There are a lot of different factors that go into place that lead up to where we are now in terms of brand culture. And so I focus in the last part of the book on neoliberal capitalism, on engagement marketing, on affect as a marketing tool, and look at the way in which Dove then sent, you know, creates these viral ads, these little films that are shared in media and digital media, and how they have workshops and this new self-esteem fund, so they get into sort of cause marketing or socially responsible marketing, and all towards this kind of co-production with a consumer. And so the reason why I think that this is a very useful way to understand the differences between commodification and branding, to get back to the first part of your question, or the last part, is because commodification is sort of a process, right? You take something that hasn't previously been commodified, like a racial identity or, you know, a gender identity, and you use the processes of commodification to make that identity into a commodity to sell in a market. Branding is something that is much more broadly conceived. It is a landscape on which we construct our identities, in which we make purchases, but we also make decisions about our lives depending on, you know, our relationship to brands. It is a more diffused process rather than just a sort of mechanism, an economic mechanism. So what I'm trying to do in the book is again, to say that branding is not just an economic tool. It's not just an economic mechanism. It is part of culture.
Right. There's a kind of excess of meaning, as you put it, at some point. And it's not in this chapter, but in a later one, you quote Raymond Williams, who is himself defining his term structures of feeling. And he uses the phrase social experiences in solution, where in this case, solution is in the kind of referred to in the chemistry sense.
Right.
And it does seem to get at what you're talking about now, the way that brand culture is permeated the broader culture in such a way that it's not merely economic.
Yeah, I think I have always found Raymond Williams useful in my work, and I find his idea of structure of feeling, you know, especially useful. And that notion that it is, you know, a context that is created in solution, like chemistry, where you have different elements mixed together, and in that mixing and merging, a new context is created. So it's not just, you know, so when economics merge with culture in the way a brand culture in the current moment, you have not just commodification, but you have something that is about cultural practices and everyday life and economics. And together they form a different sort of context. And I think it's that context that we need to contend with in order to really understand that bigger question of what's at stake in a life lived through brands.
Great. And, you know, in this chapter, you're also kind of making a distinction between the niche marketing. You've already referred to it a little bit on the one hand, which, you know, you describe as being kind of up through the late 20th century and this more kind of brand culture period in the early 21st century, which, as you say, involves more engagement and a kind of blurring between producer and consumer and all the immaterial labor that we as consumers are doing. And so if you could just explain the periodization that you engage in this chapter.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when, you know, again, this is also sort of residual from my earlier work on Nickelodeon, where I was really looking at niche marketing and niche channels and thinking about what was happening and what Joe Turow called breaking up America, right, mm-hmm. into these different markets that were discrete markets, right, that had discrete demographics and consumer citizens and everything else. And what I see as a niche marketing certainly hasn't ended, right? I mean, cable television is still a very important media form. We see niche marketing all over the place. But what has extended, and lots of people have written really, you know, wonderful work on this, what has extended, I think, within neoliberal capitalism in the current moment is that niche marketing has become more individualized and more customized. So if niche market is, let's say, if niche markets are about masculine, you know, the niche market is about male academics, that's a particular group that's specific, much more specific than a broadcast model, but it still includes quite a bit. What I'm trying to say in brand culture is that the targeted audience is you, Jeff Pooley,
mm-hmm.
right, as an individual, and you are going to get ads that are customized to you. So with Dove, for example, they have this one video that features a girl named Amy. And she's hiding in her room because she doesn't like her appearance. And there's a boy outside knocking on her door. And at the end of the, and she doesn't answer the door because she's too embarrassed about her appearance. And at the end of the video, the tagline says, you know, Amy can count 12 things wrong with her appearance today. Her friend can't count any or something. There's a way in which you can substitute your name for Amy's name.
Mm-hmm.
So that it becomes Sarah can count 12 things wrong with her appearance. And that, I think, that is the crucial change. Again, Joe Turow in his work on marketing maps this terrain out as well. And he moves from Breaking Up America to his newest book, The Daily You, right, which is about actually the sort of relentlessly individualized message of neoliberal marketing. And that's what I'm trying – that I think, is a key difference in that kind of historical period between niche marketing and individualized marketing or individualized networked marketing. So certainly niche marketing hasn't ended, but it also has led to a different sort of marketing in a different sort of capitalist context.
Great. And, you know, in the chapter that we're just discussing, you approach the topic from the point of view of a brand. But the next four chapters, you really are looking at these spheres of social life that have been thought to be outside the market's purview. And, you know, one of them is the self. And it's, in fact, the next chapter, you look at the way in which, I think it's a really terrific chapter.
Thank you.
The way in which the self is a kind of brand, particularly for young women, and you're focused on gender here, and that the brand is often involving visual self performance on, you know, new sites like YouTube, relatively new, and Facebook, and that in the chapter you're discussing the kind of complex ways in which post-feminist ideals are mixing with media making savvy and with the wider branding culture. And so if you could just perhaps talk about, you know, maybe the example of Facebook self-performance and why young women are the focus.
Young women are my focus in that chapter, and actually they're the focus of my more recent work as well, because I'm very interested in how the discourses, as you just said, the discourses of what has been called post-feminist culture are deeply interrelated with the discourses of neoliberal capitalism, which in turn are deeply interrelated with the discourses of participatory media. And I really feel like the entanglement of these different sorts of practices have created a really shifted space for young women and girls to create self-identity. And I'm not particularly complimentary of that space that has mm-hmm. been created. I'm worried about it and I'm critical of it. And so I really wanted to focus that chapter on that entanglement of those different discourses. And so that's why I focused on young women and girls. It certainly does. Self-branding is something that men and boys participate in all the time. It wasn't an exclusive focus, but it is really my interest and what I'm really particularly worried about in the current moment. And so in terms of self-branding as a practice, in terms of something like Facebook, the reason why I feel like these are spaces that are ambivalent spaces is that there are lots of ways in which Facebook can be an incredibly useful tool for people to not only craft personal or professional identity, but also to network with friends, to network with communities, to spread messages, political messages. You know, so there's lots of different ways in which this site is used. It is, I think, structurally, a site that is about the individual and about you know, creating a personal profile, which is what I talk about in the book, and what that means to create the self in digital media. is sort of my question and my focus in that chapter. And you know, what I'm arguing is not that there's some sort of insidious or perverse desire on the part of every individual to create a self brand, but what I am arguing is that the structure of new media spaces like, or digital media spaces rather, like Facebook, create a context and an environment where it's almost impossible to not create a self brand. And, you know, whatever you post on Facebook, it can be as anti-corporate as you want. It still builds the brand of Facebook, right? You are still operating within a branded space. And if the tools you have at your hands are also part of this brand culture, then it seems quite logical that what you would be doing is establishing your own identity in terms of a self brand rather than something else. And so that's what you know, and Facebook is just one example, among so many, right? I also talk about YouTube in that chapter. Clearly, I don't talk about Twitter. But clearly, Twitter is very, you know, part of this whole landscape, as are other social media sites, as are blogging, blog spots. You know, the entire sort of digital media spaces are often organized around how to build a self brand, and I worry about that because I worry about the language and the logic of branding, and I think that it becomes easy and convenient and sort of axiomatic for us to think about ourselves within this branded culture. And I want us to just stop and pause and think about what it means to think of ourselves as products instead of people.
You do, though, point out that there's a kind of paradox involved in even making a kind of point of resistance, like posting an anti-branding statement or an anti-Facebook statement to Facebook, in that the space itself is branded and the activity of the posting can be read as a kind of branding move. And I mean, indeed, in the next chapter, it's a really interesting look at street art. And you're looking at a couple of cases like Banksy and Shepherd Fairey, where indeed these figures are presenting themselves as subversive, playing up kind of illegality and the political dissent in some cases, and certainly their authenticity coming from the street. But at the same time, they are adept self-branders, and they manage their attention very carefully, and in the process have helped kind of create an interest in street art as something like a kind of commodity itself. And so this chapter is really, really fascinating. But I mean, this tension between, subversion and authenticity on the one hand, and self-branding seems to come out really clearly in the case of, say, Shepherd Fairey. And you could talk about that, but in connection with what the chapter describes as this move to promote a creative city, often with Richard Florida's creative class argument as backdrop, and the way in which, in this case, kind of creativity itself is part of brand culture.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do in that chapter is really build on some arguments that others have made, Angela McRobbie in particular, about this sort of meritocratic discourse that everyone can be creative. And this is Richard Florida's line as well on his consulting website and his books and everything else, that innate, that people have innate creativity and it just needs to be brought out in these particular ways, and then we can all benefit from it. And what I wanted to do in that chapter is to say that actually this sort of, anthem of everyone is creative it may be true, but everyone can't be branded as creative. And so what I wanted to do is talk about how, cities are increasingly organized within public-private partnerships. So it's not just federal or state funding, city funding to rebuild cities or for gentrification or for safety or for sanitation. It's a public-private partnership. So city planners are partnering up with corporations to create things like city walks and you know, a tourist revenue spots and the creative, what Florida calls the creative city. Within that, you want to have something that feels edgy and urban, but is also kind of, you know, can exist within the confines of the branded city or the branded creative city. And so certain street artists are able to be successful at that. Banksy and Shepherd Fairey and some others are part of that group where they have enough edge and enough sort of subversive history that they can be, that they give that creative city its urban feel. They give it its authenticity, right? But at the same time, they're corporate sponsored. You know, their Cadillac sponsors Shepherd Fairey as well as other people's. Banksy's, you know, work sells for hundreds of thousands of dollars in auctions. You know, it automatically raises the sort of revenue value or the value, the cultural value of an urban building. He is a brand in and of himself. And even though he, you know, has this whole sort of mystique personality, no one knows really who he is and all that, his brand is based on that unrecognizability. He cultivates that very carefully, right? So these are people who are able to use their subversion and their creativity in a way that makes them sort of palatable as a brand. And my point there is that creative cities are not, they are about a particular kind of racial grammar, if you will, and a class grammar. So, so it's not about immigrant populations. It's not about African American street artists, really. Although clearly there are some street artists who are sponsored, but it is about particular kinds of street artists that kind of merge well with the creative city brand. And so, this idea that everyone can be creative may be true, but not everyone can be branded as creative. And that's what I'm kind of interested in that chapter.
You have this fantastic reading of Banksy's involvement in a Simpsons credit sequence. And, it, you know, if you could just reprise that a bit and describe how that example, you know, fills in your argument.
Sure. I mean, that is, you know, this is where Banksy was hired to write the storyboards for an opening sequence of The Simpsons that, in particular, called attention to outsourced labor, and in particular, outsourced labor in Korea and other Asian nations and cultures, and he, you know, he was used, in part at least, the sort of conventional folklore goes, because the creators of Simpsons were upset with Fox for outsourcing labor, and so they wanted to do, like the Simpsons often does, they wanted to sort of make a parody of this and a critique of this and call attention to it. And so Banksy was used as a person who could add this sort of creative layer to this, which he did, right? Mm-hmm. But he also made sure that his name was visible, you know, on the billboards in Springfield, you know, in the opening credits. You know that it's Banksy. You know, you have Bart Simpson and his chalkboard writing instead of, you know, I will not skateboard. He's saying, I will not write on walls. There's, you know, a way in which it really solidifies the Banksy brand, that those opening credits, which doesn't necessarily take away from the social critique those opening credits are making against, you know, in terms of outsourced labor and inequitable labor practices and all the rest, right? But it is also about establishing Banksy as a brand, and those two things exist simultaneously.
You know, this chapter and the chapter before especially, you've elaborated a kind of critique that doesn't depend on there being a strict separation between agency and cultural dopedom, let's say, but you nevertheless are advancing a critique. And this is true, too, in the fourth chapter where you're looking at politics. And here you're interested in ways in which the consumer movement has shifted over time. And you know, maybe you could talk about how you argue it's become more individualistic, that the focus has shifted to the consumer as the beneficiary of the activism that you're discussing. And you know, the bottled water example was really interesting. And you also discussed urban farming.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm, you know, trying to show there is that you know, part of, you know, in every chapter, I really try to give a sort of sense of the history of these branded cultural dynamics. So, you know, the history of street art and the history of broadcast media in the Dove chapter. And in this chapter, I really wanted to show that there has been a shift in consumer movements. There's long been a very vital consumer advocacy or consumer movement, or consumer politics in the United States. But there has been also a sort of recognizable shift, so that consumer politics in, say, the mid-20th century were really revolving around access to the market. So they're revolving around inequity. You know, who had access to the market and who didn't? And how can we create a consumer market where everyone has access to that market? In the current moment, consumer movements are really revolve much more around, rather than access or inequity, around individual choice and what are the individual's options for making different sorts of purchases or having different sorts of consumer access, rather than a more widespread critique of class inequity in the United States. And so what I wanted to talk about, that, you know, in terms of brand culture and in terms of how activism itself has become sort of a social commodity. And this is also a theme that I picked up in a co-edited volume that I co-edited with Rupali Mukherjee called Commodity Activism, where we talk about this idea that social action is commodified and branded in the current neoliberal moment. And that's really what I'm focusing on in the chapter on politics. And I wanted to choose, you know, there's so many different, I could have chose, you know, I could have talked about the Obama brand or the Republican brand, or, you know, there's so many different ways to talk about branded politics. I wanted to talk about bottled water because it's actually sort of something that so many people in the United States consume, mm-hmm. and so many of us, including myself, right, are completely, you know, do this completely automatically, and we actually live in a country that has, by and large, potable water for us, unlike many other places. But we buy bottled water, we expect bottled water, we are seen as not good parents if we don't give our kids bottled water. You know, it is something that is truly a manufactured need in the sort of traditional sense. And so I wanted to talk about how that works to create brand stories like Aquafina and Evian and Perrier, and how that becomes a branded culture, a branded context for a certain sort of politics, because it, you know, the bottled water industry spins on things like safety and recycling and good for the environment, when we know that all that plastic is really not good for our environment. And so I chose that as a sort of case study to look through how this shift in consumer advocacy takes place from something that is about inequity, class and economic inequity, to something that is more about individual choice and individual consumption. And the urban farming example, I also wanted to talk about in terms of how when politics are branded, they're also branded along racialized and class-based lines. And so urban farming is something that, say, you know, I live in Los Angeles, immigrant farmers have been practicing urban farming for years and years and years in this city. But when we have a focus on it, it's the things like farmers markets and Whole Foods markets and the different ways in which, you know, I use this example in the book about how there's rent a farmer where you can, you know, have someone come and plant, you know, organic vegetables in your garden, and then you can have them in your home, and that there's a way in which, you know, only certain sort only a certain definition of urban farming can be branded. And so that chapter is really about how politics, not every sort of politics can be branded. There are politics that can be branded, and that's really important. And I think does, you know, the branding, environmental branding, green branding has done a lot of good, right? But it's also something that can be branded, and we need to pay attention to that. What can't be? What is left out of branded politics, and why is it left out? What are the reasons why it's left out? And I think those are the sorts of the questions that we need to be asking.
Good. I mean, and finally, in this last chapter that deals with these fears of, you know, social life that had been thought to be outside the market, you look at the way in which brand culture has suffused religion itself, and you look both at prosperity Christianity, which is absolutely fascinating, and there's a lot of rich historical context. It's a great chapter. But you also look as your second kind of case at New Age spirituality and the ways in which a kind of, I don't know, kind of class-based Orientalism appropriates sort of Eastern religion in what is kind of called in this umbrella term New Age spirituality, and the way in which it is quite similar to some of the bottled water and urban farming discussion you bring up in the previous chapter. It is a kind of space for personal branding.
Yeah, I wanted to end the book with that chapter because I think that for people who have a religious identity, I think that authenticity is an enormous part of that, right? And for people who have a religious identity, I also think that that binary that I try to tease out in every chapter between, you know, this idea that somehow there is a pure space of identity or pure authentic space that is separate from a commercial or corporate space, I think religion really taps into that, right? That there's this way in which it feels outside of the crass commercialism of our everyday lives. It's where we go to escape from that, right? It's where we go to escape from crassness, where we escape from commercialism, from strategy, from, you know, kind of malicious intentionality. It's where we go to find our authentic selves. And I don't want to question any, you know, again, this chapter is not about questioning anyone's faith or questioning faith at all, but it is about, you know, saying how these ideas of authenticity and religious identity have actually been part of the market for many, many years. And, you know, so I start off with early, you know, sort of prosperity preachers and early preachers who were, you know, PR people and ad people, and that's how they got the message across. And there's this way in which authenticity was branded in a religious sense for, you know, many, many years. So there's this, you know, idea of what Diane Winston calls, you know, faith in the market, that these are imbricated practices rather than separate ideals or separate spaces. And so I wanted to use those two examples, prosperity Christianity or health and wealth gospel and the rise of the megachurch and the prosperity preacher, and this New Age spirituality, which is about sort of escape from all that, escape from materialism, escape from, you know, consumerism, but only those people who have the material means to do that escape, right? So only people who actually have the financial means to afford something like a yoga retreat, right, are the ones who can benefit from this, you know, escape from materialism. So I wanted just to point out some of the contradictions there.
Well, I thought that worked really, really well. And, it, you know, it's a fitting end to the book. I mean, the ambiguities involved in religion, which, as you say, is this space that's set aside in the culture as being unquestionably outside the market and authentic, the way in which you make that much more ambivalent works very well. And it's a fitting end to the book. And, you know, and I wondered if there was anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about, an idea that threaded through or concept or an example that you want to talk about?
No, not really in terms of the book. I mean, I you know, the ideas that I put forth in the book are obviously, you know, sort of selective, as all of our ideas are. And there are so many different ways in which we could talk about brand culture that I don't talk about in this book, right? And I really just, I really wanted to focus on this idea of ambivalence, the idea of authenticity as a branded concept, as a branded dynamic or cultural artifact, rather than something that somehow sits outside of consumerism and outside of capitalism. Those are the kinds of things that I really wanted to bring forth in the book and talk about. And for me, in doing the research, these areas, the self, creativity, politics, and religion, were the ones that kept coming up as important sites for those for those sorts of contradictions and those ambivalences. And so that's, you know, why I focused on them. But there's, you know, as you know, there are many different ways to approach brand culture, and this is just sort of my take on it.
And so given that fact, you know, is your next project going to, you know, take a thread that you started to develop here or an idea that you came across while you're working on this and expand on it? Or what do you have planned?
Well, thank you for asking. I have been working on something that is sort of an extension of this. I've found that chapter 2 on branding the self in girls and young women and post-feminism, both the most frustrating chapter to write and the most, I was the most passionate about, you know, in terms of my own political and theoretical leanings. And so I'm kind of extending that chapter, those ideas that I put forth in that chapter. And I'm looking at markets again, and I'm situating these markets for girls and young women in what I'm calling an economy of visibility. So rather than branding itself, I'm looking at visibility, especially in digital spaces, as a sort of economy. And I don't want to use economy and market exactly the way they're used in economics, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm talking about culture and there isn't a neat fit. But I also don't want to use them as mere metaphors or as sort of sexy cultural studies terms, right? I want to think about how markets are formed, how consumers are identified, how cultural and economic value is deliberated in these different markets for girls, in again, this economy of visibility. So I've written some stuff on what I'm calling the market for self-esteem and talked about how self-esteem becomes a particular kind of commodity, a particular kind of market where an industry develops around this idea of self-esteem that has a very particular target, a very particular demographic in terms of white middle-class girls and women. And then I also am looking at the market for empowerment and thinking about how empowerment has been used as a sort of empty or floating signifier, right? That we're not really sure what we're empowering girls to do. We keep saying we have girls empowerment groups, we have nonprofit organizations, we have corporations that are devoted to empowering girls, but to do what? And so that's kind of what I'm exploring in that. And what does it mean to have empowerment in a digital space if, say, your reproductive rights are being taken away in the United States? You know, what is empowerment about, and who does it empower, and through what vehicle is it empowering? Is it through the body and that sort of thing? And so I'm looking, again, at these sort of different markets. So it's not about brand culture per se, but it is about neoliberal markets, and it's, for me anyway, it seems like a kind of logical extension from authentic.
Absolutely. And the idea of a kind of market invisibility, particularly around gender, just captures something about what's going on right now. And the gendered aspect of it in particular.
Yeah, I think that it makes sense for us to pay attention to the Time magazine cover of a couple of weeks ago when you have a young girl taking a selfie and the whole culture of selfies and what that means. And I also am doing some work on the market for likability and this idea of liking something, thumbs up, giving it a heart. I just read, you know, I've been collecting 17 magazines, which is this whole other sort of torture, but on the latest 17 magazines, it's Tip 17 magazine that has an article about it's hashtag cute hairstyles is the name of the article, and then it gives you a bunch of different hairstyles as a teenage girl to play around with that are, quote, guaranteed to give you tons of likes. That whole culture of what of striving to get likes and what like means, what the like button means on Facebook and on Instagram and everything else, is really interesting to me, and I think it's a very gendered concept, and so I want to explore what likability means in the current context.
I mean, that sounds so deeply fascinating. And, you know, I just as an example of this, maybe a kind of illustration in the culture, I don't know if you saw the New Yorker post about Lindsay Mills, Edward Snowden's girlfriend, and her blog, her exhibitionism on the internet, as the headline had it, the ways in which she displays herself both sexually and in other kinds of self-expressive ways, even as her boyfriend is complaining about the kind of privacy invasion that's going on in, in the government sphere. So it's a kind of perfect distillation of these different gendered expectations.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I do think that obviously the economy of visibility is something that is, you know, that is not just something that applies to women, right? But being visible in a particular sort of way, like Snowden's girlfriend, is something that is seen as empowering, and is something that is seen as likability, in a way that is not the same for men, and in a way that actually, I think, distracts us from, again, thinking about the more structural violences and structural policies that are going on now, to you know, dismantle Roe v. Wade, dismantle reproductive rights for women, domestic abuse rights for women, and that sort of thing. So there's this way in which visibility and empowerment means something very different depending on gender.
Great. Well, I mean, the project sounds really wonderful, and best of luck with it.
Thanks.
And yeah, and thank you again for taking the time, and congratulations. The book, I should mention, won the Outstanding Book Award for the International Communication Association. It's just a terrific book. And again, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
You've been listening to New Books in Communications. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.